Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
We're joined in this portion of our program. I'm Bob Salter, and I've been looking forward to our discussion for some time because the title of the book that we're going to be talking about is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Now, you say that title, and in most cases, you get an immediate reaction. We're going to speak with the author of the book, Bernice Hausman. Bernice is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine. I'm pleased to say that she is joining us on our program. First of all, good morning. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
In beginning this discussion, was that the only title for this book?
The first part, anti-vax, was. The second part, boy, that had a number of different iterations. The first one that I was working with for a long time was making sense of vaccine skepticism. And then there was a time when the title was a little bit clunkier, the subtitle. It was Vaccine Skepticism Tells Us About Medicine, or Teaches Us About Medicine and Modernity. And that comes up, that I think now is the title of the conclusion to the book.
Mm-hmm.
So reframing the vaccination controversy was a conversation with the editor after she felt that the subtitles were just not doing the book justice. And the just as a funny side note, there was a long discussion about whether or not the should be in the whether it should be the vaccination controversy or whether it should be reframing vaccination controversy or reframing vaccination controversies. And I actually did a little crowdsourcing with friends of mine over email, my colleagues of mine, about whether we should have the in there or not. It was quite an amusing experience in retrospect. The issue was really whether or not we were implying there was only one.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, actually, it was a colleague of mine who used to be a journalist who said you need the in there because that's going to make it more less academic sounding and more inviting to the general reader, which I thought was really an interesting insight, and we went with that.
In your background, as I understand, you were vaccinated as a child, later as an adult, and in all honesty, I was vaccinated as a child as well. You had your own children vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Why this book? Why this approach?
So I study medical controversies in the public sphere, and I was finishing up a project and looking around for a new one, and I was also And at the time, I knew that colleagues of mine and friends of mine who had children after 2000, my kids were born in the mid 90s, that they were, even if they were vaccinating, they were worried about vaccinating, and some of them were delaying and kind of changing the recommended schedule for their children's vaccines. And I was really interested in that. I was sort of interested in why they had those concerns, and at the same time, I was also interested in developing a collaborative research group with students at Virginia Tech, where I was teaching at the time. And I was really interested in a topic that would capture the imagination of my students, who were mostly pre-med, the group of students that I was seeking to engage in this research and teach them about how to do humanities research as a team. And so I thought that this would be a good topic that would draw their interest, and I was right. Since that time, I've had different groups of 4 to 5 students every semester since 2010. Doing research on this topic. And now I have moved that research group to Penn State College of Medicine, and I have medical students working with me on a project right now.
The vaccination decisions with your own children, you describe them as non-decisions. Why?
Because it was just what happened when they went to the doctor as infants and children, right? Somebody would say, well, now it's time for this vaccination, and it was sort of part of the regular set of activities that happened during well-child checkups. And I wasn't in a position at the time to think about questioning that. And my kids also, my kids went to daycare. They started in daycare when they were about a year old, each of them. And there were requirements to in sending your children to daycare in Virginia, just like sending them to school. So I was a conformist, like most parents, and didn't really think about it. But I also wasn't part. It was interesting because I was a member of La Leche League, and which is a breastfeeding support organization. And in sort of breastfeeding circles that I was in, there were parents who were questioning vaccines. But I, for some reason, that whole conversation really was not a part of my social networks when my children were little, and I really only became aware of it. As I said, through colleagues and friends who were having children 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years after my kids were born.
The people who refuse vaccination, does anybody have any grasp on how strong or how, for better way of phrasing it, I guess, is how large a group of people this is?
It's the number of one of the ways that we measure this is the number of children who are fully non-vaccinated. It's still very, very small in this country, under 2% of all children. Now, that number has been increasing. I think there was a recent study done that showed that children who were born I'm going to forget the actual sort of dates, but like basically there were sort of two dates that were chosen in the 2000s, and it was shown that from one period to the next, there was an increase in the number of children who were fully unvaccinated. Now, that said, there's also been a decrease over the years in the number of children who are not vaccinated because they lack access to medical care. And this started with the Vaccines for Children Act in 1993 under Bill Clinton, which made federal provision of vaccines for children on state Medicaid and other forms of provision easier. And I think that it increased under the Affordable Care Act under Obama, as insurance companies are required to provide vaccines that are routinely recommended by the CDC. So what you see is what I argue early in the book is that the proportion of children who are sort of purposefully non-vaccinated may be increasing proportionally within the group of children who lack vaccines, but that number overall is very low.
Mm. But, you know, the beliefs that the parents are expressing, the parents of those kids who are not vaccinated. Some people might think, that's kind of, they're out there, so to speak. But their beliefs are not really fringe, are they?
It depends on who you talk to. There are some fringe beliefs that occur, but of course there are fringe beliefs that occur in all portions of the population. Most of us have some belief somewhere that is kind of an outlier. One of the things I try to do in the book is demonstrate that that things that bother people about vaccines, the people who are vaccine dissenters, are actually quite common, or common trends in contemporary culture. So, for example, distrust of big pharma and its relationship with medical, government medical regulatory groups that make recommendations for vaccines, distrust of government bureaucrats making decisions for the rest of us, concerns about the environment, concerns about what we do to our bodies in the service of health that may in fact cause other harms that we're not tracking. Those kinds of concerns are not limited to vaccine dissenters, it's just that they turn this particular set of concerns to vaccines in ways that the majority of the population does not.
Mm. But vaccination, has it ever been, I guess, universally accepted in our society?
No. There's a kind of a myth that vaccines used to be accepted, by the sort of, well, I guess here, I'll start again. Vaccines have been accepted by the majority of the population in this country as a preventative health practice. But there have always been a significant portion of people who resisted vaccines, or who were skeptical of vaccines, or who vocally dissented. And you can see it, historically it goes all the way back to the late 18th century when the smallpox vaccine was invented, and especially in the 19th century in both Britain and the United States, there were riots against compulsory vaccination. Another good example is the 1950s when the polio vaccine was developed and then federally licensed and disseminated in the mid-1950s. There's this sort of mythology about all of these children who were volunteered by their parents to take part in the vaccine trials, right? So these were the last part of the experimentation process to make sure that the vaccine was safe and effective. And it is true that hundreds of thousands of children were volunteered by their parents to get this experimental vaccine, the Salk polio vaccine. But it's also true that hundreds of thousands of children in the catchment areas for the trials were held back by their parents and not allowed to participate in getting the experimental vaccine. And so you see there this kind of tension between after it was licensed and disseminated, there were immediate concerns that not enough parents were getting their kids vaccinated. There had to be these sort of persuasive campaigns and mechanisms to get people to be vaccinated. So there's always this tension since the invention of vaccines between those who are sort of proponents and kind of zealous adherents, and those who are more skeptical, who want more time, who want to see how other people respond to the vaccine, or who really are just against vaccination and do not want to be vaccinated.
That's the voice of Bernice Hausman, who is chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State College of Medicine. She's talking with us as the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. More with her as we continue in our program. Bernice Hausman. Bernice is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine. I'm pleased to say that she is joining us on our program. What about media coverage of vaccines, vaccination? How has that changed over the years?
So that was a really interesting finding. One of the things that I was interested in looking at was sort of trying to answer the question of why we have such inflammatory coverage now that it tends to be vilifying and shaming, even from very venerated news outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post. So I had a group of students look back at sort of mainstream news reporting on vaccination from about 1980 to 2015. And what we found is that through the 80s and through the 90s, the news reporting was really what you would expect, relatively neutral. And there was actually a lot of sympathy for parents who were concerned about vaccination dangers. So there was very sympathetic reporting about parental concerns with thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative that used to be used in vaccines in the United States. So the reporting really changed after 2000, and especially, I argue, after 2004, 2006. And there were sort of a variety influences on that change, but 9/11 happened, and there was an increased concern about bioterrorism and the anthrax scare that happened right after 9/11. And then in 2004, there was an Institute of Medicine report that could not find connections between either thimerosal or MMR and autism. And so the notion was that there was a scientific, there was a set of scientific studies that did a large meta-analysis that demonstrated no connection between those, the vaccines and autism. And then in 2006, when Gardasil, the human papillomavirus or HPV vaccine was licensed and approved and recommended for use among preteen girls, there was a huge backlash when states started to try to mandate the vaccine, and parents, especially parents on the Christian right, decided that were against that. And so then there became this sort of mantra in the news that, look at these conservative parents. This is a vaccine that prevents cervical cancer. How can they not be in favor of it? And so there was and then, of course, there was the introduction of social media and Facebook, 2004. And so you have this that changed the way we report and we talk about things in the media. And you have these influences that lead us to a situation today where much of the reporting is vilifying and shaming, immediately moving towards an analysis that it's got to be anti-vaxxers who are at the cause of every outbreak of infectious disease that we have. And the truth is always more complicated than that.
Bernice Hausman is talking with us on our program. She is the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. As I mentioned in introducing her at the beginning of our discussion, she is the chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine. You mentioned the A word a few minutes ago, autism. Mm-hmm. And since 2000, or the turn of this century, a lot of the attention that has been given vaccines has focused on the potential connection to autism. What do we really know about that potential connection?
Well, that depends on who you ask, but there continue to be significant portions of the vaccine dissenting community that are committed to the idea that there's a connection between vaccines and autism. The mainstream biomedical researchers have not found a linkage, and so there continues to be persistent sort of pressure on that point because of this disagreement. Now, what I would say is that what's interesting to a researcher like me, who's researches the cultural context, is the question of why, in the face of such kind of a staunch repudiation of this idea from mainstream biomedicine, is there a persistent belief among people? Why do people go to the meetings of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC three times a year, where a group of experts makes recommendations for vaccine use in the American public? Why do people go and at public comment continue to talk about the connection between vaccines and autism? To a group of people who do not believe that there is a scientifically demonstrated link. So there's very, very interesting sort of cultural cultural sort of conflict going on there, and the persistence of this belief in the face of a lack of scientific evidence, or at least a lack of scientific evidence that mainstream scientists agree on, is really a kind of a fascinating cultural phenomenon. I don't have an answer for it.
Mm. The role of parents takes many forms. And in an age where, you know, we have all this information literally at our fingertips, or at least the access to the information, how does a parent act responsibly when it comes to vaccination?
Well, you know, Bob, this goes back to the question you asked me initially about my non-decisions about vaccinating my own children. Mm-hmm. And because I think that it's a fascinating thing that we're, in general, when it comes to health practices, we're recommended by many different kinds of experts to do our homework and to inform ourselves about what we're doing and not do things blindly. And yet, with vaccination, we are in fact rewarded by following the recommendations of the CDC in following a particular schedule when it comes to vaccinating our children and, in fact, vaccinating ourselves. What we see is that school entry mandates in this country, which are state-level laws that demand that children have a certain number and kind of vaccines and boosters before they go to enter into organized daycare or schooling, that those are really what maintains a rather high level of vaccination in this country, because when we see vaccines that are recommended but then not included in those school entry mandates, uptake is much, much lower. And so whether or not that is an effect of parents paying more attention and doing their homework, or just the logistics of vaccination that mean that they just don't, you know, get around to it, is very unclear, but you see that people's sort of disposition is not necessarily to follow through with recommendations unless there's a kind of a situation in which you know the rubber meets the road and you have to, otherwise your child won't be able to go to school. Question about parental responsibility, of course, is the focus of one of my chapters, and it really is this. For parents who do take that question seriously and are dedicated to ensuring that they know everything that goes into their child's bodies, they oftentimes run into a wall where it's unclear to them that vaccination is safe based on what they see as the ingredients when they research themselves the ingredients of vaccines. Now, on the other hand, you could argue that we have history of safe monitoring of vaccines once they have been licensed and approved and are routinely given out to millions of children every year, that we have a sort of set of monitoring activities where the safety and efficacy of vaccines is, in fact, monitored quite closely by the federal government and others, and that that monitoring system does not demonstrate significant adverse reactions to the routine vaccines of childhood. But that's where you really have a kind of a disagreement among vaccine dissenters and mainstream biomedical government regulators.
Then how do we also begin to build a sense of trust when it comes to a realistic discussion about vaccines? You know, you have people who, as you pointed out, are dissenters, they're disbelievers, people who think that, you know, basically the people are lying to them. How can there be a consensus on this, or can there be?
Well, So I don't know that there can be a consensus in agreement about vaccines and their either efficacy or their safety, but to start a new kind of conversation, that is really the whole purpose of my book. And what I would say as a beginning point, and this is really why I wrote the book and why I wrote it in the way that I did, why I looked at the things that I looked at, is that we have to actually, instead of simply saying, well, the scientific evidence demonstrates the safety and efficacy of vaccines for the vast majority of people, we have to look at the reasons why people dissent from vaccination and think about those reasons as meaningful rather than as irrational, wrong, purposefully deceitful or misinforming. And I think that taking a perspective that suggests that people's beliefs are based in something and that something is valuable and necessary to understand rather than something to dismiss, to suggest is crazy, that's the starting point. Because you can't have a conversation unless there is some kind of common ground that people are coming to this set of decisions or this topic in a good faith way. People who work in public health, people who have to go into communities where there are outbreaks of infectious disease, know this. They know that in order to be effective in containing an outbreak or maintaining the health of the community, they have to meet people where they are. And that has been this really interesting problem with vaccine dissent, is that an inability or a refusal to meet people where they are and address the concerns, the specific concerns that they have in a meaningful way.
The NFL preview is along at 7 o'clock this morning. JJ in the morning line at 8:30. And, of course, Melusis and Deal with that fabulous Football Sunday program along at 9 here on The Fan. Bernice Hausman, who is chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State College of Medicine, she's talking with us as the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. What have you learned about yourself as you've been conducting this research?
So I have really learned that to sort of set aside my own views and set aside my own inclination to think about other people's views that I disagree with as crazy or irrational, and to really try to understand the logic behind the views of people that I don't agree with. And to make a space, in a way, to make a space in which I try to identify at something with the positions of people that are acting differently than I do with respect to this question. The research that I conducted prior to this book, I wrote two books about breastfeeding, and I wrote those books as an advocate as well as a researcher. And in this case, when I was doing so, I was not really neutral in the same way that I am now about vaccination, although that previous research did give me some of the skills that I use now in this current research. But taking a neutral position with respect to vaccines in order to understand the controversy has really changed the way that I think about the way that I go about my research. It's made me more of an anthropologist, more of a, not an observer, but when I engage in these conversations, I have to really bracket and put aside my own personal views.
Final question for you, because this is an area that has been in the news in different areas of the country. In New Jersey, this was a huge issue recently at the State House,
mm-hmm.
where there was a move to abolish exemptions.
The non-medical exemptions,
exactly.
Yes. Yeah. So that's actually been, I think we're in the middle of a really interesting kind of natural experiment with respect to that. New York got rid of its non-medical exemptions this year. California did that in 2016. Maine has done so, but I think it will take effect next year or the year after. And I believe Washington State got rid of non-medical exemptions with respect to measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR. So it's an interesting, historically, non-medical exemptions have worked to dissipate political dissent about vaccination by allowing some people who are really ideologically or otherwise opposed to vaccination a kind of an out, so that the vast majority of people will be vaccinated and the mandate will hold. So it's kind of like you allow some people to opt out in order to ensure that most people opt in. So historically, it's worked that way since the first conscientious objector laws were passed in Great Britain in 1898. So we will see whether or not in this country now, given this sort of the changes in the laws, whether or not there's a change in the way that these vaccine mandates work politically. My apprehension is that people who are against vaccination are very, very worried about the increasing mandates by restricting the non-medical exemptions. And I think it's going to lead to increased political dissent from vaccination because people are going to feel backed up against a wall. And you see that in the incredibly vociferous dissent that occurs when this legislation is considered at the state level. I also think that you will see, as we have seen in California, an increase in medical exemptions and an increase in homeschooling, as the law can only cover those children who are in organized schools. And so the question of whether or not that outcome is worth the marginal increase in vaccination levels, I think we will be able to track that and study that in the future. States like New Jersey and New York have actually extremely high levels of vaccination, and the question of whether these laws are going to give us higher levels, I think, remains to be seen.
Bernice Hausman, who is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine and the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy, our guest this portion of our program. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful discussion. Certainly the best with this book and with your work.
Thank you.
We're joined in this portion of our program, and I've been looking forward to speaking with Colin O'Mara for some time. He's president and CEO of National Wildlife Federation. Joining us on our program, talk with us about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program.
Bob, thanks for having me on this morning.
How do you describe what the fund has been about?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, for your listeners, the easiest way is if they've ever gone to a park or a playground or a state park or a national park or a forest or a wildlife refuge, they've benefited from this program. The Land and Water Conservation Fund takes a small amount of money off of royalties from offshore oil and gas development and then invests it in projects across the country. There's been projects in every single county and across the entire country, more than 41,000 projects that have been done through this program in the past 50 years.
And what exactly is happening with this now?
So there is a great bipartisan effort in a time where there isn't a lot of bipartisanship to permanently authorize the program, which means allow it to kind of be funded. But now there's a big bipartisan push in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate to permanently fund it. The program's supposed to get $900 million a year, which is a portion to the state of the different federal agencies. It's only ever been fully funded twice. And so there is a big push right now to try to make sure that those resources are there, because at a time when more kids are looking at screens and folks are increasingly living, spending most of the time indoors, and the need to have great outdoor places for folks to recreate is more important than ever.
You say it's only been fully funded twice?
Yeah, and it's in 54-year history, wow. In 1998 and 2001. And that was really specifically around a couple projects in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem that they were trying to, it was a mine they're basically bought after they kind of reached a negotiation that having pretty significant gold mining operations in the just outside of Yellowstone wasn't really a good idea. But yeah, but only twice in the 50 years.
But I mean, this is protecting, you know, am I overstating this to think this is protecting some pretty important stuff?
Yeah, I had a chance to testify before the Senate the other day on this, and I said, like, this is how you protect the places that make America America. And, you know, in the 50 years since the program started, our population's gone up by more than 130 million people. We've lost, you know, 80, 90 million acres of outdoor spaces to development and housing and energy development and roads. And so this is like the one program that works across the entire country to try to make sure that those special places are available. So no matter what zip code you live in, no matter what your income is, you can enjoy kind of the amazing outdoor recreation that really just makes America unique in the world.
Mm. Wow. I mean, are there numbers in terms of what outdoor recreation means, like, to the economy and things like that?
Yeah, it's funny. We didn't start tracking it until about in the last 10 years. But it's an $887 billion, billion with a B, billion-dollar economy. It supports 7.6 million jobs across the country. And the interesting thing is that these are jobs that are in, you know, cities that are close to destinations, but also in some of the most rural communities in the country. These are folks that are, you know, running, you know, hotels or restaurants or retail shops or, you know, fish and tackle shops, or, you know, the whole range of support services that are needed when folks want to travel. And it's not just around the, you know, the famous, you know, national parks like Yellowstone or Yosemite or the Tetons or, you know, Zion or Bryce or the places in Utah. It's, you know, jobs that support in places like Jamaica Bay, right? When folks want to go visit the refuge there, and they're going to have a meal, or maybe they rent a kayak or a canoe. It's all those additional jobs that we would not have if it wasn't for programs like this protecting special places for all of us.
Mm. We're talking on our program with Colin O'Mara, who is president, CEO of National Wildlife Federation. Joined us on our program talking with us about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Now, this legislation, what's the likelihood, if this passes both houses of Congress, of this actually being signed into law by the president?
The interesting thing with the president is that if you can get it to his desk, he's actually signed most things, because that also means you got through the Republican Senate in the process. And this is one of those programs that's interesting because it does benefit everybody. And so you have very conservative senators from, like, Western states that are huge champions of this program, as well as some of the most progressive members, you know, from the New York delegation. And so I think it's one of those areas that shows that, you know, there are some things left in Washington, maybe not many, that can still unite us across parties, and having, you know, high quality outdoor spaces and more kids outdoors and, you know, protecting our cultural heritage does seem to be one of those. And, you know, there's still some folks that are concerned about the price tag or, you know, but there's, you know, the amount of money we spend on other things in the federal government that really don't always benefit everybody. This is one of those programs that gives everybody a shot to enjoy the great outdoors.
And what role can people who are listening to our discussion today play in this?
Yeah, I think New York's benefited incredibly well. I mean, the city itself's got, I think, $350 million worth of projects in the last few decades. Anyone that's enjoyed, like the boardwalks and the trails around, like the Rockaways, or like at Coney Island, like Clemente Park, Battery Park. I mean, all these, you know, kind of major destinations benefit from this program. And if they get an opportunity, I mean, just letting their member of Congress know. Some folks, Ignatia Velasquez, has been on the committee. She's been a leading champion of the program for a long time. Obviously, Senator Schumer, in his leadership role, has been pushing for this and been a great champion as well. But if they do have a chance to you know, reach out to their member of Congress, that's always helpful to say this is important because we want to have these great places for the to be protected for the future. There's a lot of new members, for those of your listeners that are in kind of northern New Jersey, and a lot of those members are new, just letting them know that it's important as they're trying to find their way and find the bathrooms and all the challenges of being in D.C. But I think just showing that it's, you know, this is an American issue. This isn't Republican. This isn't Democrat. I think most folks want to have strong, vibrant local economies. I think the more they hear that from us, the better. If they want to visit our website, it's the National Wildlife Federation, NWF.org, NWF.org. And there's information about the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and we can do everything for folks if they want to contact their congressman or send them something on Twitter, and we can help with all of that. But again, this is the kind of, you know, it's lowercase p politics, right? This is just saying, hey, let's do this good thing that you guys are fighting over so many other things.
Colin O'Mara, who is president, CEO of National Wildlife Federation, on the web at nwf.org. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing these insights. This is something we're definitely going to be watching.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for joining us on our program this Sunday morning. You know what program's coming up next. Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge. JJ in the Morning Line at 8:30 and at 9 o'clock, Football Sunday action. Melusis and Deal here on The Fan.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Once upon an office so dreary, Wendy's HR presentation made everyone weary.
Was it a bore?
A snore. Could have used more charm for sure.
That's it.
Wendy opened Canva, looking ecstatic. She began to work her magic.
Docs, prints, presentations galore. All in one design. Not dull anymore.
The next day, Wendy wowed the crowd. They clapped loud.
I feel so proud.
Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at Canva.com.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see Rates and Fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.